Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. In the center of Iowa, in the center of Ames, Iowa, and we're glad to be here, and we're glad that you joined us, too. Happy Halloween, everybody.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
No.
Boo.
Okay. Whatever the appropriate things to say on this day are, when the veil between the worlds is the thinnest, it is a very special day. Besides for trick or treat, in the Roman Catholic calendar, there's a cross holiday or something like that. I forgot.
Oh well, it's a Day of the Dead.
All Hallows Eve, right? And I believe it's called Samhain or something like that in the old Wiccan tradition or something like that. Anyway, it's time for introspection and darker, deeper thoughts and all of that sort of thing.
And putting the garden to bed.
Yes.
Because,
there you go.
Because we are getting a little nip of fall. Yes, it is. So Halloween, here in the United States, we think of it as a kind of a kid's holiday. There's a lot of sweets and things and holiday Halloween candy. And we start with the Halloween candy, then we slide into the winter holiday sweets. But Not so long ago, people didn't have so many sweets like we do, or possibilities of sweets. Matter of fact, about 100 years ago, people ingested about 2 pounds of sugar per year total, huh?
And they were lucky to get it.
Lucky to get
it. And scarce.
Now,
it was
now
expensive.
We are up to well over 150 pounds per person.
Oh, you know, I'm afraid to say I do my share.
Makes my teeth hurt, but I do enjoy my sugar, too. So we're going to be talking about sweet things today, and actually a sweet that we don't hear much about, sorghum. Sorghum. In mid-September, I got to visit a local sorghum pressing, which was kind of a unique thing for me. That was good. And the person who's going to talk about that is Ben Hoksh. He's been on the show before. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good. Ben is a botanist, a banjo player, a prairie enthusiast. He's a trimmer of trees, a keeper of bees. He's a forager and a maple syrup maker, and he had another sweet adventure. He organized and pressed a sorghum pressing and pressed sorghum. Tell me about that, Ben.
Yeah, well, this is the first year I got to experiment with it. Being a sugar maker with the maple and the honey, you meet other people and you start learning about other forms of sugar that can be made and, carve yourself out as a little niche as a farmer. And I hear about some people boiling sorghum with their maple syrup equipment. So I figure, well, that makes some sense. We should probably check this out. So the way it went is I kind of spent about a year and a half just kind of casually thinking about, finding a sorghum press or, trying to get my feet wet somehow. Reached out to a couple different places to try to get a tour, but never really worked too hard on it. And I had mentioned it to a patron at the local brewery Alluvial a couple of years ago and said I was looking for a sorghum press. And he says, well, let me step outside and call my brother. And returns back inside 45 seconds later and says that there is an auction in Missouri tomorrow and they have all kinds of that stuff available.
Oh, my goodness. So, where in Missouri? So that tripped your trigger. That's good. I was surprised that people are talking sorghum. I always thought that was a southern thing. Although, I do remember my parents talking about some sorghum makers up in little hollows in Wisconsin, and actually seeing, especially in the Amish community up there, along the road, the signs for fresh eggs and fresh bread, sometimes you see sorghum, and I really don't know too much about it. So this is good. So you went to Missouri to get a sorghum press.
Well, I had to work at the bar the next day as well, and I had to sign up for the online auction. Excuse me. And it was a pretty busy day at the bar, and I'm trying to help people at the bar, and I'm also bidding on an sight unseen, what I think is a press that will work for me. And it's a Victor number 1. It was patented in 1863. I don't have a serial number on it to tell how old it actually is, but it could be 170 years old. And it still works like it's brand new. I was having a friend build a stand for me, and we were talking about, you know, getting this thing fired up for the first time. You know, it's a horse driven or a mule driven press. With human power, you can do that if you want. You kind of walk around in a circle, and there's a pivot point up top that makes these big rollers kind of turn in on each other. And the first one crushes the cane, and the second one actually juices the cane. And, you know, I was telling my friend that I'd heard that you can overload them, and if you overload them, you know, they could catastrophically fail, and it's kind of dangerous at that setting. My friend...
Overload by putting too much pressure on it?
Putting too much cane inside between the rollers, this thing has to be moved with a bobcat, you know, with a loader of sorts. And my friend Jake just kind of stopped what he was doing and looked at me, and he goes... You could drop this thing out of an airplane and it would just make a dent in the ground. And
okay, so it's not
heavy.
Okay, yeah. It's not catastrophic to the press. Okay, yeah. I've seen this thing. It's a big, heavy thing painted a bright green. So it looked very promising, very promising.
Yeah, well, we got it to turn and decided that we were going to... be able to grow sorghum and have a community event around the harvest and processing of it. And the weather cooperated, the land cooperated. You know, I was able to farm this up associated with Root to Rise Farm in Ames. They're a community-supported agriculture setup associated with Alluvial Brewing. And they gave me a quarter acre to plant and grow.
So that was a quarter acre of sorghum.
Yes.
It's very tall and quite beautiful, actually.
Yeah, I ended up getting the seed from a place called Sandhill Seed Preservation. They're out of Calamus, Iowa. And the fellow there does some really great work, saving these varieties. And from what I remember, it's called Mennonite. And I think it originated, or at least this original seed came from Iowa. For his seed bank, but it is, you know, not a North American crop as we know.
Right. I kind of looked this up, and there's actually it is related to sugar cane, what we think of as sugar cane. But as I found out, there's sorghum and there's molasses. Molasses comes from the processing of sugar out of sugar cane, and that comes from the Caribbean, and there it was grown for rum, which I suppose is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then further reading says what we consider the sorghum plant, which they're both a grass, and it came with the African slave trade from Africa specifically as a sugar, as a syrup, as a something to sweeten your life.
Yeah, the original crop, you know, it originated in northeastern Africa, and some of the earliest archaeological evidence related to it, you know, puts it at being domesticated and farmed on a pretty large scale, you know, 5,000 to 8,000 years ago.
Ha! But isn't it also used for animal feed and?
Yeah, animal feed, and then the grain is still used heavily in Africa as a food source, and it's kind of
you eat the grain and press the stalk.
Well, yes and no. I mean, by the time the grain is ready to be harvested, you know, the plant has taken all of the sugar, all of the energy out of the cane.
Oh, so it's an either or situation.
Yes. So if you want to press for juice, the plant has started to flower and it's just starting to make seeds. And you want to harvest it at what you call the milk stage, which is when you crush a seed, it kind of looks milky, you know, it's pretty soft, it's early dough, you know, milk stage. And that is when you cut it and harvest it for...
Yes, I was surprised that your pressing was in mid-September. And yes, you go out there and there are seed heads there, but they are not crunchy dry as you as thinking of seed heads. These are big, big plants. And I noticed you had the plants were harvested by hand. A lot of good friends and acquaintances out there whacking away. Wow. That it was a lot. Looked like a lot of work, Ben.
What did you cut it with?
Well, I've since learned some other ways to do it since the first day. But yes, machete. You know, the classic Central American tool.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
And yeah, you know, the process was basically, you know, strip the leaves as they're standing. And then, you know, you can cut the cane down, you know, about 6 inches from the base. And then you lock the top off. You know, about the top 6 inches or a foot doesn't really have a whole lot of sugar content to it, the old timers are telling me. But that's also the part of the plant that has the seed head. And when you run it through the mill, you don't want to have that seed head in there because if you were to crush those seeds and then go to boil that juice, it's going to leave different impurities
in
your
syrup.
Yeah. And that boiling process, you know, after you press, it's basically about reducing it down so their sugar content gets higher, but it's also boiling it down so you can skim the impurities off of the syrup that you're producing. Like you don't need to strip the leaves off the plant, but if you don't strip the leaves, you're going to have a lot more skimming to do as you are reducing the sugar down because it's essentially a thick green grass stalk. And, you know, boiled down grass with sugar probably tastes pretty good, but if you can get that chlorophyll, get that green flavor out, that's going to give you a much nicer product in the
end.
Plus
it's less to run through the press, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's more work on the front end to cut it all down, but it's less work when you're skimming. And, you know, there's always, you know, different ways to get it done.
Give us a visual, because we're on the radio. How tall was the cane before you cut it?
So the cane averaged anywhere from 6 to 9 feet tall. You know, these machetes were great tools, but I did learn a really cool way from a family.
What about a buzzsaw, right?
Yeah, I mean, folks do use chainsaws, I've seen. But a nice sharp blade works really well. For the leaves, there was a woman who came by and she was showing me a tool that that her family used to use because they made sorghum in Iowa up until the 1970s on a pretty large scale. It was kind of cool to see these people come out of the woodwork, you know, once the word got out that sorghum was being pressed. You know, I had people just showing up who were like, you know, heard you're making sorghum. It's like, or, it's like, I've never heard it called that, but I think I'm doing it, you know. And then they sit by and they, you know, give you all these tips and tricks and that kind of thing. But back to the harvesting, this person brought by a tool. It essentially just seemed like a piece of lath, you know, like a 4-foot-long piece of wood, you know, that was about 1/4 inch wide by 2 inches, you know. And then it was sharpened to look like a sword, but a dull, you know, just a wooden sword. Mm. And then there were notches that were made about every 6 inches on that blade of said wooden sword. And you could just run that wooden sword down the edge of your stalk of the sorghum. Because it wasn't sharp, it didn't cut the stalk. But it was sharp enough that when those notches kind of, they would latch into that cane and then it would knock those leaves off quite easily. And then you're also not wielding a, you know, 1.5-foot long machete above your head when there's 7 other people in the field around you. You can hand that to a 7-year-old and they're going to be doing okay.
You know what that reminds me of? Every once in a while you'll see these at auctions. Not so much anymore. They're almost gone. But have you ever seen those corn huskers gloves kinds of things? Mm. They're straps with spikes on them, and you put them on your hands, and they were for when everybody was hand husking the corn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Old tools that have really specific uses are quite fascinating.
Oh, amazing, amazing. And actually, you had a beautiful day for this. I remember going out and seeing. I stood on the side and took a few pictures. I did not go out and whack away at the cane myself. But then, I get back to the press. All of this long cane was taken to the press, and all the business happens inside of this circle. There's this fantastic old site of this old sorghum press.
Are we going to get to the most exciting part?
Yes, most. And there's people inside feeding things in, but there are horses on the outside.
Two beautiful. What were they? Were they French draft horses?
They're the ones that are bigger than Clydesdales. I can't remember what they're called.
Oh, golly, there's a...
All the horse people listening are probably shouting it out to them.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, it's kind of a dapple.
Percheron.
There we go. Yes, there's that word.
Good job, both of you.
Oh, my goodness, there was a pair of them, and the children got to ride on them round and round in the circle. And that was so exciting.
Yeah.
I was impressed or brought to mind of the energy that goes into a process of producing any food stuff, but this is producing a sweet. Those horses were not exactly, you know, pulling out huge stumps or pulling huge log wagons, but they were working to keep this thing going. You said the press could be moved by people. Could you move it by people?
Yeah, you can. You know, it's kind of, you know, we're describing this press, so you've got like at a central location, and then there's a very specific sized and shaped log that I cut, you know, a piece of ash that has kind of a creative bend to it. So it starts about 5 feet off the ground and then ends up, you know, bending down to about a foot and a half off the ground, because that's where the horses and their tack, you know, their equipment kind of latches into these things. So the longer that is, the easier it is to turn, but also the longer it is, the slower your press turns. So if you made it 10 feet longer, it'd be quite easy for, you know, a couple of people to turn it by hand and to press, but you'd have to go around twice, you know, in the same amount of time it would take the horses to go around once. And, you know, depending on how many horses you can find or active volunteers you can find, you know, you can cut your tree to whatever length you'd like. But the thing about it is, you know, this is like the first year we're doing this. So like we come to learn that we didn't make the stand quite tall enough and the log was almost the right shape. So every time it would come around, you had to duck, so you wouldn't get knocked in the head by the log coming around. And more than once, it you know, good thing it's going slow, but just a reminder that...
See, things we learn. Yeah. And again, the energy it takes to, well, not only grow the stuff, but to process the stuff. And then the people in the middle of this press... I was part of that process. I was smart. I sat down on something, a crate, I guess. They're busy feeding. Well, one person feeds it in, and I was on the other side. I was told it was helpful to kind of pull it out. So I was pulling out the squashed bits.
Yeah, it does a pretty good job of getting, you know, all the juice out, and it's quite a long process, you know, and it's one of these things that, you know, historically it was a community event. You know, everyone in town would, or everyone in the community would have their own sorghum patch, and that would be their source of sugar for the year. But one person generally owned a mill, and people would go and they would harvest collectively and then take that cane over to the
mill is stationary rather than traveling.
Yeah, okay. Because they are so big and heavy and hard to move, you know, it's one of those things. It'd be much easier to bring a wagon load of cane over a couple times than it would be to get this thing, you know, moved. So, you know, Iowa has had those kind of cooperatives in the past. And, we just, as I was seeing this happen, you know, like unfold and the people show up and, you know, young farmers there helping and learning, I thought it'd be a great idea to try to get a sorghum cooperative going one of these days. But we'll have to find another person who's excited about it as I am, which might take a little while.
It's wonderful. Oh, back to the press and the setup there. The Percherons, that's the kind of horse. So... where did you find these horses, and what did you do? You said, I need horses that know how to walk in a circle. Is there some certain skill
harnesses, too, that are appropriate, right?
Yeah, and I'm not a horse guy, so it's one of those things where the event is – you know, happening in, you know, 3 weeks. And the person who said that they could help decides that they, you know, they can't help. It's the situations arise. And they really weren't prepared to be pulling with harnesses or anything. Anyway, we were just going to try to rig this up. And
what, just tie a little rope around the horse's neck and hope he pulls the thing properly?
You know, I'm the guy growing the crop. I'm not the person with the horses. So, you know, that ended up falling through. And then I was able to just kind of reach out to a horse friend and say, hey, I'm looking for horses to pull a thing.
You have
that
a horse
I'm
friend?
Making.
This is like Mr. Ed or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, of sorts. But, you know, as I'm, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I need a horse that can pull things. It's like, oh, you're looking for a draft horse. Yes, a draft horse. I'm looking for a draft horse. And as you keep talking to these people, you learn the language to use and you learn the name of the harnesses and the bolt patterns that you need to match up with the things you have and tell them all the bits and pieces. And the person who ended up coming out, one of them was a friend from high school. It was her and her husband. And they've been doing some horse pulling with carriages for a little while, and they thought it'd be really fun to come out. So I ended up trading him a beehive. So in the spring, I'm going to be getting him set up with bees. And he came out and helped for a couple hours in the morning with one of his horses. And then I was put in contact with a fella who does the carriage rides out at Center Grove Orchard and pulls, you know, carts of people around out there as well. And was able to hire him to come out and, you know, run for about 4 or 5 hours, which,
Those were the Percherons?
Yeah. So, you know, if you talk to one horse person, they're going to put it out to their network. You know, it's like you talk to one maple syrup maker or you talk to one person who grows garlic and you're going to be able to figure out everything you need in about 2 weeks.
Well, the Percherons came with a lot of harnessing and just beautiful leather work and so complicated.
Oh, they brought their working clothes. They did good. So after all of this pressing of stuff down, there is the boiling. And you said very similar to what you do for maple syrup boiling.
Yeah, you know, all these things where you're making a syrup, you know, it's essentially you just get it hot and water leaves.
Reduce, yeah.
The thing with sorghum that I didn't have experience with because, you know, you do some filtering when you make maple syrup, you know, a little bit at the beginning to get the bits and bugs and bark and stuff out. And at the end, you know, you filter the final product to get, you know, sediment and minerals that precipitate. But with sorghum, you're basically filtering the whole time. You're skimming. So you have these different tools. You know, one of them, an old-timey one is, you know, a copper scoop shovel, almost a small one with holes in it. And as you're boiling, this green kind of thicker, foamy type material just like starts, it's like scumming up the top. And you need to have something to be able to skim that off, whether it be one of these old-timey copper tools, or you've got like wooden slats that have holes in them, or you're using like stainless steel fryer mm-hmm. basket type of scoops. I've learned that it's very specific to the size of the material that you use to scoop and how you scoop specifically. I definitely need to improve on that method for next year so I'm not losing product. But basically just keep adding wood, keep that fire boiling hot, and keep skimming until the foam that is up top doesn't look green anymore. It starts to look golden brown as opposed to yellowish green.
You can't burn the stalks as part of your fuel, can you? Are they too green?
You can probably burn them. You would need to have wood, you know, going at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah. All the excess that we had on site was used by the farmer to mix with spent grain from the brewing operation at Alluvial. to add like a nice green component to that high nutrient grain mash. So she's doing, you know, her own chemistry and alchemy with making soil out of the
compost. Turned into compost.
Okay. Oh, that's great. So how much stuff did you end up with your patch?
Well, as you boil,
just guessing,
it takes about 10 gallons of juice to make 1 gallon of syrup.
And compare that to your maple syrup.
Maple syrup, the trees that I tap are very sweet. They're open-grown trees, so this ratio is pretty low compared to national averages. But it's about 35 to 1. That's a very good rate.
So sorghum is easy peasy then.
Yes, it's very easy. And very easy with quotes, right? I ended up making, I think it was 30 to 35 gallons this year. It's interesting too. Sorghum is a much thicker and much higher sugar content syrup than maple is. Maple syrup, is legally maple syrup at around 66 or 67% sugar. And that's because if it's lower than that, it can spoil easily. If it's higher than that, it'll crystallize. You know, it'll make sugar inside of the jars and bottles that you have. So there's kind of a sweet spot. With sorghum, you know, it can still crystallize, but it can handle being a lot thicker. And traditionally, sorghum is about 10% higher sugar content than maple syrup. So it's thicker. It's like, I think in Kentucky, the legal lower limit is 76% sugar. I had batches this year anywhere from 78 to 82. That 82 one is really thick.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. I kept it in the fridge the other day, and I went to pour it out of the refrigerator, and it
didn't move,
didn't
right?
Move. Yeah.
Good sign. We're talking to Ben Hoksh about sorghum. We're going to take a little break here and come back for more. This is KHOI. This is Donal on the Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donal on the Kitchen. That was a tune called The Dancing Bear. I thought it had some kind of Halloweenish there. Kind of a nice, wonderful driving tune. We are talking to Ben Hoksh about a recent sorghum pressing that happened here right in central Iowa. Lots of good information about sorghum and stuff. Do you have anything else to say about sorghum?
Well, I'd say if you haven't had it, I'd highly recommend it. It's a yummy product. It's got a lot of uses. You know, anywhere you would use a maple syrup or a honey, you can definitely use this product. It's something that used to be the main sugar source here for a lot of reasons. If you can find a local producer, I'd go ahead and support that. One of the longest running producers in the state of Iowa, or the longest running producer, goes all the way back to the 1800s. And they're using the same steam-powered setup to boil their sorghum. So,
oh, amazing. What part of the state is it in?
I think they're near Brooklyn, Iowa. I'm like kind of southeast.
You can buy it in stores sometimes. Yeah, that's,
yeah. I mean, they're a large.
I think I have a jar in my pantry. This is delicious, Ben.
I'm glad you think so.
And it has, when we pop the top off, it actually has a nice odor to it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's really.
I haven't tried it, well, I guess, since this morning, but might as well try it again.
Yes, try it again. That's good.
I put it in my coffee.
Yes, yes.
I was thinking about, it's not as strong as molasses.
No, it's like a slight fruity or citrusy kind of back, but it's also a little funky, you know, like buckwheat honey reminiscent in a way.
Yeah, I don't think it's any stronger than some of the buckwheats that I love to use. It is also, it's a little bit, tastes a lot like, you'll read some English recipes where they talk about using golden syrup or treacle to make like sticky bun thingies or something like that. And this has the consistency of that, and I bet it would be completely interchangeable.
Oh, yes. Recipes. We'll get into some recipes later.
So, speaking of other syrups, there's a couple other things that I've been looking to, you know, as a sugar maker, I'd love to just make sugar full time. That sounds great. Contribute
what
my
a 100, sweet life!
Contribute to my 150 pounds a year. And I don't actually eat that much sugar. I probably drink it. It's just right out of the bottle most of the time. but I'm going to be experimenting with apple cider molasses or cider syrup this year, and that's essentially just boiling down apple cider.
That's something you could make in your home kitchen.
Definitely.
You know, in fact, Lana and Joe made cider this year, and we talked about it, but we didn't do it. Although I have some cider in the freezer. You just put it in the pot and you boil the juice, the fresh apple juice, which is apple cider, basically, not hard cider. And you just boil it down.
Yeah.
Boil.
I can't imagine that would taste bad, you know? And then the other one that I have some watermelons. I was told watermelon molasses is a thing. Now, I did some reading on it, and it was pretty mixed, you know, reviews.
Oh, goodness.
One of them described it as like a, if you like blended summer squash and then boiled it with sugar, the juice from that, and boiled it. So it's very vegetal in taste. And, you know, I could maybe do a couple of batches of that and see how a few gallons sell at market.
I don't know. Would you have to pick the seeds out? That's annoying.
You know, I got plenty of filters and strainers and, you know, from all this years of trying this stuff. But, you know, I want to see how many things I can make sugar out of.
Well,
in Iowa.
A lot of fruits.
Oh, good.
We have had both dehydrated watermelon slices and cantaloupe slices. And they are, when you freeze, no, you dry them in your dehydrator. We actually called them watermelon candy.
Yeah.
It is delicious.
If you can get rid of that water, I think you go for it, Ben. You are always into something. Good. I am so glad you keep experimenting. This is good. Well, so good luck in all your adventures and keep going with that sugar. And also you can veer off into your cordials and wine, too. That's not a bad use for
sugar. All right. So you haven't fermented. What would you... You could mix some of the sorghum in and some...
Of course I haven't, but...
You're thinking about it. Fermenting
but
stuff.
But if a person... Like, I like the idea of making a rum out of it. You know, it probably tastes pretty good.
Ha! See?
Well, do let us know. But just that, if it were rum, you would have to distill it then, right?
Correct.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
But
okay.
That's a whole nother process, Ben.
Okay, good. Well, good.
Yes,
we'll call
thank you.
Ben Hooch instead of Ben Hush.
It runs in my family, but yes, I got to go south to Tennessee to work on that.
Okay.
But thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I always enjoy being on the show.
Thank you, Ben. That was Ben Hoch, and he was talking about sorghum and all the other sugary things he does. Oh, Donna's got the sorghum jar out, and so we'll probably just be keeping...
We'll keep licking
our spoons for the rest of the show. But Donna's got some recipes that can use this sort of thing. There is a difference between molasses and sorghum. Just in that
there's some flavor difference.
Yeah.
But I might try this. We're talking about gingerbread next, which I think is, since it's Halloween today, we are firmly at the beginning of gingerbread territory.
There we go. I think your timing is excellent, and I love gingerbread. So what kind of gingerbread recipe do you... I mean, there's gingerbread snaps, and there's... Okay.
Yeah, snaps, cookies, houses, all of that sorts of things. But the straight gingerbread is more... We start, at least in my house, with making more like a cake, or... you can bake them in a brownie pan or whatever. I used a recipe. This is becoming one of my favorite baking books. It's Alice Medrich, who is the queen of all chocolate baking. She she was the first to start a bakery that mostly produced chocolate truffles in Berkeley. So she's been doing this a long time, and she is a meticulous writer. Her recipes are always perfect, and she has this book. It's not a new book. You can buy used copies. It's called Sinfully Easy Delicious Desserts, Quicker, Smarter Recipes by Alice Medrich. Now, the beauty of most of the recipes in this book, and I'm getting really addicted to it, is she uses her food processor to just whip up all these cakes and tarts and it's kind of like one pan baking. I mean, you can bake something like, okay, last night I made chocolate macaroons. I ended up with three bowls of, one for the chocolate, one for the egg whites, one for the mixing the whole thing up. But this thing where she does it with just the bowl of the food processor makes the cleanup so, so easy. So she has in this book, it's called A Fresh Gingerbread. Now what she does, as in fresh ginger, right? So she doubles her ginger. Using powdered ginger is kind of the go-to standby. Ground dried ginger is familiar to all of us. It's in a jar in your spice shelf. It's pungent and earthy, and it has a little more peppery flavor than the fresh ginger. But so what she does is she starts with actually quite a bit of ginger. This is one of the most gingery gingerbread recipes I have ever had. So a piece of fresh ginger that is at least 3.5 by 1.5 inches, which is 2.5 to 3 ounces. So it's a good size knob of ginger. Now, when you buy ginger in the grocery store, remember to buy ones that are heavier in your hand. That means they have more juice in them. If it's kind of light and too gnarly looking, it means it's dried out and it's lost a lot of its juice. So you want those big fleshy knobs. And she says to peel it. I use a vegetable peeler. It does not mean to get every little bit off of the knob. So she peels that and then she drops, kind of roughly cuts it because it's a little tough, into bits and just starts the food processor with mincing that into a fine ground mush, so you're not getting fibers and stuff. And then she puts in 2/3 cup of light brown sugar or muscovado sugar, 1.5 teaspoons of ground cinnamon, then a teaspoon of ground dried ginger, and 1/2 teaspoon of allspice, and 1/2 teaspoon of ground cardamom. Okay, now I will say on the cardamom thing, this is my usual caveat. Cardamom, once it is ground, will lose its flavor rather quickly. So when you're measuring cardamom in a recipe, if your cardamom is not like really fresh, and cardamom, after it's been ground and been in the jar for, even 3 or 4 months, it's not very strong. You can kind of practically throw it out. So I keep cardamom either fully in the husk and I fresh grind it, or you can buy it just the seeds and then grind it fresh, because when you grind it fresh, you're getting that flavor. Or Burlap and Barrel has like an extract of cardamom, like a vanilla extract, only cardamom.
Oh, really? That'd be handy.
Didn't I give you one for Christmas last year?
No, because I would have used it. I'll get some myself.
Christmas is coming again. I love the cardamom extract. Like, I will, if I make it a cup of coffee, sometimes I'll just put a shot of the cardamom in that, or, you know. So anyway, with cardamom, the strength of the cardamom, you know, determines how much you need. So she's got a half teaspoon in. So I would say that should be really fresh. Then a half teaspoon of salt. And then this is usual. This is the defining thing of gingerbread. A third cup of light unsulfured molasses. Like
light molasses, not this heavy duty.
No, blackstrap molasses is not for cooking.
Okay. What's it for?
It's for medicinal purposes.
Oh, really?
Well, okay, so molasses is made by the sugar cane juice is boiled, and as it crystallizes and turns into sugar, it's lifted off, and what's left in the bottom of the pot is the molasses. So it is a byproduct of sugar refining. Now, the regular unsulfured molasses, which is what we buy, the typical brand name in the store is Grandma's Molasses. It's been around forever. It is not boiled again. Blackstrap is boiled two or three times more and becomes super, super concentrated. So it's really strong and very dark and very thick. And mostly people use it because the molasses and the blackstrap molasses are where all, they're very high mineral content.
Ah.
So, you know, the thing is people eat it for its healthy thing, but you know, you got to realize, of course, it's still sugar.
Yeah.
But people old timey used to use it as a, you know, kind of mineral
tonic.
Yeah. Here, have your teaspoon of blackstrap molasses here, you know, that sort of thing.
So if we're talking lighter molasses, perhaps sorghum.
Well, this is where I was thinking I might try a version with the sorghum and see if it really still hits that gingerbready note. It would be close.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think if we're going to substitute sorghum, I would use it more the way golden syrup and the English use it to make treacle and things like that. Then she puts eight tablespoons of butter, an egg, a half a cup hot water, a cup and two thirds of flour, and baking soda. And it kind of all just goes successively into the Cuisinart. You just keep adding, pulsing, and then you scrape it into your prepared baking pan, and there you go. That it was the most gingery gingerbread I have ever had. This is Alice Medrich, but look for some of these gingerbread recipes. And if it doesn't do it, I always add more ginger. I like it really, you know, even if I'm making a ginger snap or something like that. Consider using fresh and dried ginger in all of your holiday baking. It really adds a nice kick to it. Now, this is so gingery that I had to make whipped cream to go on top.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yes, I did.
Good. Well, thank you for that recipe. We're kind of sliding into the fall here. Gingerbread. You're listening to the Donalana Kitchen, this is KHOI. To find out more about this fine station and about this show, go to www.khoifm.org. Another tune by the Barn Owl Band. I mention that because we just, actually the past 2 weekends, I had the good fortune of being able to call a dance to the Barn Owl Band. We did some contras and squares. 2 weeks ago, we were in Indianola, and last weekend, we were here in Ames, people dancing around. Tis a good thing to do. Well, we're talking about fall sort of tastes here, and we talked about sorghum and mentioned molasses and gingerbread. What else do you have for us, Donna?
Well, we're talking about children and candy, right? Because it's Halloween. I want to encourage you, if you ever have a group of like 4, 6, 8 children that are roughly between the ages of 7 and 10, maybe.
Okay.
Taffy pulling.
Oh, and you're kidding. It sounds sticky.
It's sticky and it's fun. It's something my mother did for us a number of times as a child, and I suspect it's because it was something she did growing up. There's good recipes in the Joy of Cooking and things like that's basically sugar and flavoring. But the thing is, you're making candy and you get this, you have to butter your fingers. Everybody has to butter up your fingers. And then you take the taffy, and this is why it takes older children. It's basically hot boiled sugar. So you have to take it out of the pot and it has to be just barely cool enough to touch. And as soon as you can touch, it takes two people and you start pulling it into a long rope, and then you lap it over itself and fold and pull again and until as it cools off.
What does the pulling do?
It must put air into it or something, and it cools it off in a way that makes it a long rope by the time it's finished. And then when it's soft, but, kind of room temperature, you cut it into little pieces. And then you have it, and it will get hard as it sits longer. But it's a fun activity with children. It's old-fashioned kind of thing. In fact, there is a recipe, the Little House on the Prairie cookbook, which really is full of kind of authentic pioneer cooking, things made with the ingredients that they had access to. There is a molasses taffy pull recipe, which I had done with grade schoolers many years ago, I think in Malibu or something, and the kids loved pulling the taffy, right? Because it is fun. But they didn't like the molasses flavor.
Oh!
Modern children don't love molasses. They're so used to sugar in many, 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 many forms.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Just think when something like molasses or sorghum would be an absolute treat.
Yeah.
But we've got, I'd rather have the stuff out of the corn syrup.
Yeah,
version.
the gummy bears,
yeah.
Right?
Oh.
But you could, you don't have to make the molasses recipe in the Joy of Cooking. There's this, standard ones. You can drop flavors into it, like orange flavored extract, or of course peppermint is the classic, but lots of children don't really like peppermints. But you can just make it vanilla and vanilla and sugar. All children like vanilla and sugar, and it is fun.
Oh, that sounds like a good fall thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is the kitchen an absolute disaster afterwards?
It's not that messy. because everybody's being careful because it is hot. You have to have children that are not going to be idiots and burn themselves.
Okay. A good caveat. Don't have children that will burn themselves.
Yes, right. No. Exactly. That's part of the process.
Oh, very good.
Or maybe it's about teaching them not to burn themselves, I guess.
A teaching moment. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. And often, we're often told not to play with our food, but this time we play with our food.
It's really fun. It's still a prominent memory from my childhood.
Oh, very good. Halloween candy and seasonal. I always think of popcorn and caramel popcorn this time of year. That's a good another.
Oh, popcorn balls. Yeah.
Yeah. You can. I have used them.
That's another gooey thing you make with your hands, right?
Right. And also, well, not the popcorn balls. You do the caramel corn. Just make it big with the big wooden spoon. Mm-hmm. Keep chewing. And I have made that with pancake syrup. You could probably make that with sorghum. That would probably be really good.
Because sorghum is thick enough that it would
be really good. Another thing, a hot thing, work fast, and it's one of my favorite fall things. I usually generally make a pot for Christmas. That's a good thing. Oh, but also for Halloween candy, I have a confession. Halloween candy to me, it's not Halloween without candy corn.
Oh, Lonnie, there was a front page, I think, New York Times article about candy corn and how it's been devalued, and, it is making a comeback.
Well, I'm glad it is. It's terrible. It's just probably solid sugar. I've always wondered how they make the little white on the top and the little white on the pointy part.
Machine.
Right. Well, I like it because, just two or three. That kind of makes Halloween for me. And anyway, it's kind of pretty. So I like candy corn. Yeah. Of course, all the other chocolate stuff is good too. So happy Halloween, Donna. That's good. Some more thoughts on Halloween. Why do we like to scare ourselves with all the nasty things happening in the world today? The pictures we see on the news in the evening or on the internet, that's plenty scary for me. So if I'm going to trick or treat or dress up, maybe just something a little more festive.
Ghosts and goblins. That's about the level of scariness that I want to deal with.
Because this time of year, this time of year, we have the fear of the unknown, and we're scared of things.
The veil between the worlds.
And it comes to the time of year when witches show up, and witches were, they were thought to be uppity women in their time, yes, and they probably still are. Witches, independent women, wise women, crones, and somehow that was scary things for some powers that be, but
it's anti-patriarchal.
It is, and I think witches need to come into their own, and we have to honor that sort of a history. I ran across a really fine poem I'd like to end with. It's about women of a certain age. It's called Calling All Grandmothers. And this is by the writer Alice Walker, a book of poems by Alice Walker. And the name of the collection of poems, the title of this book is a poem in itself. It's called Hard Times Require Furious Dancing.
Furious Dancing, I like that.
Isn't that nice? And she's quite a wide variety of subjects in here. But she has a poem called Calling All Grandmothers. We have to live differently, or we will die in the same old ways. Therefore, I call on all grandmothers everywhere on the planet to rise, take your place in the leadership of the world. Come out of the kitchen, out of the fields, out of the beauty parlors, out of the television. Step forward and assume the role for which you were created, to lead humanity to health, happiness, and sanity. I call on all the grandmothers of the earth and every person who possesses the grandmother spirit of respect for life and the protection of the young to rise and lead. The life of our species depends on it. And I call on all the men of earth to gracefully and gratefully stand aside and let us do so. A poem by Alice Walker. There
about
it is.
About the good witches, yes.
There it is. Well, thanks for joining us today. And be careful out there on Halloween. Yes, it is. Tell us about our podcast, Donna.
Yes. The Halloween podcast will be posted in 2 days, but, it is a season. As we said, between the living and the dead, the trees are all, the dead leaves are coming down. We're going into the dark part of the year, where things will regenerate. It is a very fertile moment in its own ways because all these leaves, contribute to new fertility. Anyway, this podcast, we do this live on Tuesdays. By Thursdays, we have a podcast. If you like that format, go to wherever you listen to podcasts, put in Donna Lonna, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, one word, that's both of us, kitchen, and you will come up with the Donna Lonna Kitchen podcast.
Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lonna Kitchen. We come to you Tuesdays at noon, repeated 7 p.m. on this fine radio station. support this fine community radio station. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. And thanks to Ben Hawks, who joined us today to
talk about...
The
sugar maker.
Sugar. What a good guy. What a good guy. Eat good food and enjoy life.